really at the center of your book, Freedom Dreams. So deeply involved with the Black Power, labor, environmental justice, and feminist movements. Before her death at the age of 100 in 2015, she was a frequent guest on Democracy Now! I wanted to turn to her in 2010.
People are beginning to say, the only way to survive is by taking care of one another, by recreating our relationships to one another, that we have created a society over the last period in particular where each of us is pursuing self-interest. We have devolved as human beings.
Talk about why Grace Lee Boggs' activism, politics, and philosophy is so important to you and so central in Freedom Dreams, Professor Kelly.
She is the center of the book. She's the inspiration in many ways for Freedom Dreams. You know, we go back to like 1992, and she started this debate with me about, you know, you need to read Dr. King. You need to pay attention to people's needs beyond protest. Like, how do you build the society we're trying to establish in time, in the present, as opposed to just continue to fight for reform? And so we had this ongoing debate, and she forced me to rethink some things. Even after Freedom Dreams came out, she had more critiques, of course. And so I end the book with an epilogue that has a very substantial section on what is being built in Detroit right now as a result of the Boggs Center and the work that Grace and Jimmy Boggs did. And so that's a really important part of the story, saying that, you know, Freedom Dreamers are basically, you know, building that society of creating new human beings, new ways of being together, that don't fall into the same old trap of, you know, the Marxist stealing, you know,
Robin,
seizing state
power.
We
have to end, yes. But we're going to do a post show and post it at democracynow.org. Professor Robin D.G. Kelly, his new book, 20th Anniversary Edition, Freedom Dreams, The Black Radical Imagination. A very happy birthday to Hani Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 8 a.m. Next up is Wednesday Talk Radio with Paul Roland.
Slick, you investors in hate, you Saddams and you Bushes, you Bin Ladens and snakes, you billionaire bullies, you're a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war, you old feudal parasites, you just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons, but your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language, you creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation. It's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers, you gambler thieves, you profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time, country after country, and crime after crime. You pretend it's religion, like there's no one to blame for the dead and impoverished in your little patriot game. Honey, that's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. You got the world's greatest power, and you team up with thugs, make a fortune on weapons, destruction and drugs, but your flags and boots and uniforms, they start to all smell the same when all sides are killing in the Patriot game. And that's how it's done. And you've got our sons in the crosshairs of horror at the end of your guns. And your national anthems.
And good morning, everybody. And good morning, everybody. This is Paul Roland. Can't hear myself on my headphones, but that's okay. I guess I'm going out over the air. And this is Wednesday Talk Radio, and you are listening to KBOO Community Radio. And continuing with our focus on militarization, climate change, and the movement for global justice, today we turn our attention to the role of the U.S. military in the Pacific Northwest. Without the United States military, this region would still be indigenous territory, as it had been for well over 10,000 years before the arrival of us Europeans. I say us because I'm one. The establishment of army forts was key to the expansion and consolidation of English and then U.S. military and political control from the beginning of colonization through westward expansion to the Pacific. And after the United States became industrialized and unified its territory through railroads and communication infrastructure and more, it continued its expansionist thrust in the Spanish-American War by seizing Puerto Rico, the Philippines, and Guam. Having territories in the Pacific increased the importance of U.S. military bases on the West Coast, which began to expand to meet the imperial reach of the new global power. World War II and the Korean and Vietnam Wars further bolstered the strategic value of West Coast bases, with the Puget Sound area becoming crucial due to its northern latitude. Today's guest, Zoltan Grossman, is a member of the faculty in Geography and Native Studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. Out of his course, A People's Geography of American Empire, came the Basewatch website project. Students researched and documented the Northwest Military Installations, Joint Base Lewis-McChord, or JBLM, Naval Base Kitsap, NBK, and Naval Air Station Whidbey Island as case studies of land acquisition, placemaking, deployment, and descent. And you can read more on my website, on my program page at kbo.fm. Zoltan Grossman is the author of Unlikely Alliances, Native Nations and White Communities Join to Defend Rural Lands, and co-editor of Asserting Native Resilience, Pacific Rim Indigenous Nations Face the Climate Crisis, as well as numerous articles for Counterpunch, Common Dreams, and other outlets. Good morning, Zoltan.
Good morning.
My headphones are still not working.
You sound great.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
I can't hear you. Hello? Darn it.
I'm here.
Okay, can we go back to a little music? I got to figure this out. Hello?
I'm here.
Sure you're slick. You investors in hate. You Saddams and you Bushes. You Bin Ladens and snakes. You billionaire bullies. You a globalized curse. You put war on the masses and then you clean out the purse. And that's how it's done. War after war. You old feudal parasites. You just sacrifice the poor. You got the cutting edge weapons. But your scam's still the same as it's been since the Romans. Yo, it's the Patriot game. Yo, that's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. It's the war racket. You twisters of language. You creeps of disguise. Yeah, disinformation. It's like worms in your eyes. You privileged bankers. You gambler thieves. You profit on war. You think it's just less money in peace. So that's how it's done. Time after time. Country after country. And crime after crime. You pretend it's religion. Like there's no one to blame for the dead and impoverished in your little patriot game. Honey, that's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. That's the war racket. You got the world's greatest power, and you team up with thugs, make a fortune on weapons, destruction and drugs. But your flags and boots and uniforms, they start to all smell the same when all sides are killing in the Patriot game. And that's how it's done. And you've got our sons in the crosshairs of horror at the end of your guns. And your national anthems, they start to all smell like shame when all sides are dying in the Patriot game.
Can't hear anything.
That's just the war racket.
Can't hear anything.
That's just the war racket.
Can't hear anything.
It's just the war racket. Hey, that's the war racket.
Can't hear anything.
And
come
war
on.
Is never, ever holy. It's just a greedy man's dream.
I can hear you. Yes,
and
but I can't
two
hear anything.
Crusaders, both sides are obscene.
God damn it.
War is not made by God. War is just made by men who misdirect our attention while you thieves do your thing. And that's how it's done. About every 30 years, the rich fill their coffers.
All right, well, I had to try Studio One, and then now I'm here in the air room. So sorry about that, Zoltan, are you with us? I can't hear him. Ah, there we go. Are you with us, Zoltan?
Yes, I'm still here.
I apologize profusely. I don't know what that was all about.
Oh, I had a radio show once in Madison, Wisconsin, and I know all about technical difficulties.
All right. Well, now I'm without all the prompts I had at my disposal on the computer, so I'm just going to have to wing it. So, tell us a little bit. I know you've been at Evergreen College since 2005, a long stretch. Before that, though, you were in Wisconsin. I know you were involved in the Midwest Treaty Alliance. Talk a little bit about how you got involved in alliances and in support of Native Americans.
Well, sure. I was living in Minneapolis in the heyday of the American Indian Movement and got involved in South Dakota in the Black Hills Alliance that was trying to protect the Sacred Hills and did from coal and uranium mining. And in Wisconsin, worked with tribes against metallic mining that threatened their sacred wild rice and fish, and built alliances with some of the rural white neighbors. And this is kind of at a time when, you know, the tumult in the rest of the world and Central America, intervention, South African apartheid, the global movement against nuclear power and nuclear weapons. And I began to make kind of connections between what was going on at home and what was going on abroad. And really, you could see it as part of the same package, the same historical origins. The American Indian Movement always made connections between settler colonialism at home and imperialism abroad. I remember the Vietnam Veterans Against the War had a beautiful Memorial Day ceremony in the state capitol in Madison, where there was a native drum, and they made that point as well. And then I read a book, Richard Drinan's Facing West, The Metaphysics of Indian Hating and Empire Building, which really made the point that the so-called Indian Wars were the template for the rest of U.S. foreign policy. A manifest destiny morphed into overseas imperialism with Hawaii, Guam, the Philippines, then Vietnam, and Vietnam was seen, all these places were seen as like extensions of Indian country. And, you know, that you had kind of the same dynamics of settler colonialism or exploiting natural resources, undermining sovereign nationhood, using ethnic and religious divisions in order to conquer a country. And we see that today in the Middle East wars, which are really an even further extension of Drinan's idea. So, yeah, in 2005, I came to Evergreen, which was a perfect place after graduating at UW-Madison in geography and Native studies, because here we teach in an interdisciplinary way to synthesize different disciplines. We teach often together, most of the time together as faculty, to integrate knowledge. There's a very strong Native programs here, both for the West Coast and the whole of the Pacific. I've taken a few classes to New Zealand. It's really the epicenter of the treaty rights history, the Bolt decision in 1974, Nisqually, Squaxin, many, many other tribes around here were fighting for their fishing rights and used that, those rights to actually try to heal the landscape, to restore the habitat. Some of the leaders like Billy Frank Jr. and the largest military base on the West Coast, formerly Fort Lewis, now Joint Base Lewis-McChord. 70% of the Nisqually Reservation was stolen on the eve of World War I to form that base. And I arrived just at the time when there were massive protests at our local ports against the shipment of Stryker armored vehicles to Iraq. So in that context, with another faculty member, Larry Mosqueda, we set up this program, People's Geography of American Empire, kind of, you know, taking the lead from Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. And and in a later version of that class, our students set up the Basewatch website, which looks at those three clusters of military bases in Western Washington.
Yeah, that's you're so right up the alley of what we've been focusing on. I was kind of casting about, sort of as I've been looking at this nexus between the military and climate change. You know, as I put it, the military has driven the whole process of colonization, imperialism, and expansion, which led to the capitalist industrial system, which obviously led to the invention of vast numbers of and different kinds of machines, and the sort of spurred the development of different fuels, leading to oil, which is now the dominant fossil fuel, went through coal, which we still use, and which led to the massive emission of greenhouse gases, which has got us into the incredibly terrible fix that the globe is in right now. And not only that, you know, militaries continued to protect the drive to secure, quote, secure natural resources, which has led to numerous wars over oil, further territorial expansions. And then, now the militaries are the biggest user, institutional user, the United States military being the biggest institutional user of fossil fuels and thus emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. And so I've been focusing on that a lot. And then, of course, you know, the militaries continue to foment tensions and conflicts around the globe, which prevents nation states from actually coming together to address this crisis of all crises. So there you have it. And of course, so then I being a sort of a bioregional oriented person, I started to think about, well, you know, here we live in the Pacific Northwest, how does it all play out here? And lo and behold, I hadn't really focused on it. We do have, as you said, the largest military base on the West Coast, and really a strategic point. I actually linked to I think it was a master's or PhD thesis on my program page about the crucial importance of the Puget Sound in the development of United States imperialism in the Pacific.
Yeah, I think it's our location at the northwest tip of the contiguous U.S. Washington, I believe, is seventh in military land. 2.2% of the state's land is in military ownership. I think Oregon is 0.3%. 0.3%. There are other states like Nevada, Hawaii, New Mexico that are around 5%. But one thing that really struck me is how, especially during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, we in a sense were on the front lines. We saw the social crisis. We saw the planes, C-7s take off for Bagram or Baghdad, and there were a lot of protests, as I noted. A lot of the Iraq war veterans were active. There was a coffee house, a GI coffee house, set up next to Joint Base Lewis-McChord called Coffee Strong for a number of years. I was involved in that. And so, in a sense, the war wasn't just something we saw on TV. We saw it around us. And there's a large military community here in the Olympia-Lacey area. And there's also a large progressive community. It's really one of the only places in the country where you have that juxtaposition. You have, in other parts of the country, military bases are very remote or in very conservative areas of the country. And so there was an opportunity for protest. There was also an opportunity for dialogue between those two communities. And we saw a lot of emergence of anti-war sentiment among soldiers and their families, and at least at JPLM, the Army and Air Force base. But our students looked primarily at JBLM, which has a fascinating history. It was formed as Fort Lewis in 1917 on the Pierce County side of the Nisqually River, and that took 70% of the Nisqually Reservation, not treaty lands, but the actual reservation, to form their artillery range. It's a big open meadow. Nisqually actually means people of the grassland. And this is a large open meadow that was perfect in the Pacific Northwest because we have so many trees. It's one of the rare places where they could do artillery training. And so through World War I, Korea, Vietnam, and really accelerating with Iraq and Afghanistan, JBLM has been a real center of training, and has been the closest base also to East Asia in the contiguous U.S. And so with the pivot to Asia in recent years under the Obama and Trump and Biden administrations, you see an increased importance of JBLM. But what's interesting is the strong environmental consciousness and climate consciousness in our area, the strong indigenous treaty rights, which was really in the 50s and 60s, 70s, was really something that was centered on some of these Puget Sound, Salish Sea indigenous nations like Nisqually, Puyallup. The Bolt decision in 1974, that's in a sense given the Nisqually tribe an opportunity to extend its power back into those lands that were stolen. And so in terms of the environmental impacts, they've had a say over how the shells and the tanks affect the salmon streams. The safety questions. They used to fire shells right over the reservation, the remaining part of the reservation, and they stopped that. The cultural sites, the sacred sites, cemeteries within JBLM are protected because of treaty rights. Every year there's a Leschi Kwemeth Honor Walk to honor two Nisqually leaders who resisted the treaty, and that's within the base. There's now a tribal fish hatchery within the base, but there's still a lot of problems of unexploded ordnance, of RDX, which is a toxin in the groundwater because of the training, and so there was an effort actually to put in that HIMARS missile system that the Ukrainians are using against the Russians right now, but it's incredibly noisy. There are a lot of problems already with the artillery. If you live in Lacey, which is right next to the base, you're often kept up nights by the artillery training. HIMARS, the missile system, would have been really, really loud and detrimental to the salmon eggs and bird eggs, so the tribe said no way, and the Army had to move that to the Yakima Training Center in central Washington. So there's still this ongoing process of colonization with the military in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, of course, we haven't even talked about Hanford and the
right.
The taking of a huge amount of Yakima Nation land to develop the atomic bomb. But so, speaking of which, was that a similar process? You said steal the Nisqually land. Obviously, they didn't apparently need much legal rationale, but under what sort of protocols did they actually seize that land, the military of the Nisqually?
The county, Pierce County, actually condemned the land and gave it to the Army.
Aha.
And the argument of some of the city fathers was this would be good for economic development, which it was.
But wait a second.
The non-native community. And so the county actually confiscated that land illegally.
Right, because that's a federal relationship. Counties should have nothing to do with that.
Yeah, exactly.
And have they ever gone to court?
The families were removed at bayonet point.
Oh, wow.
It was a real ethnic cleansing. And because there wasn't enough room in the remaining 30% of the reservation in Thurston County across the river, many of the tribal members were scattered to different reservations. And continue to be. But Nisqually has done an amazing job of asserting its treaty rights, reasserting its presence within the base. And ironically, and this happens at a lot of military bases around the country, though the groundwater is contaminated, the surface is in a more natural state within the military base. I've taken quite a few classes into there on tours with the tribe and the Army, very interesting relationship there, born out of necessity, really, because the tribe is not going to get that land back in the near future, but they're making sure that at a point in the future when they can get the land back, there's still something living on it. So despite the explosion of the artillery shells, there are species within this prairie environment and wooded environment that you don't see around in Western Washington, where it's all been urbanized, suburban development. And the tribe is actually afraid that if the base closed, it would all be privatized, there'd be condos, and they'd lose any control over what happens there. But they do have the right of first occupancy at this point, and so they would get that land back at this point. So.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see JBLM with the pivot to Asia, with the focus on China and North Korea, the Pacific. I don't see that happening in the near future. But really, tribes have been here for thousands of years. Settler colonialism the treaties were only signed in 1854-55. Very, very, very recent history. So in the long-term view of things, you have to think about the health of the land and the water. Over the long term, because that's what really counts.
Indeed, and not to mention the climate, which has been the focus of this program for quite a while. And I guess part of, as an activist as well, and sometime organizer, part of my goal, I guess, with this program is sort of to get the environmental climate movement to actually look at these issues, to sort of, to move towards the dream of a grand alliance of movements, anti-imperialism, indigenous support, etc., to actually look at the reality that we people talk about decolonization, but you know, this is a, the colonization is alive and well and exists specifically in these military bases. And as I was saying, the military is one of the prime causes of the climate crisis and one of the prime reasons why we can't address the climate crisis through, you know, what I've been saying is we really need to move towards a some sort of global framework for demilitarization in order to actually have the kind of international discussions that could actually lead towards. I think short of that, in my opinion, it's just idle talk. That's just my view.
Yeah, you were talking about the Pentagon being the largest institutional consumer of fossil fuels in the world. I think they use 1 million barrels of oil every 4 days. They would be, if they were a country, the U.S. military was a country, it would be, I think, the 47th largest greenhouse gas emitter. It would be larger than many countries like Sweden. And I think, you know, the toxic legacy that they leave with the bases in places like the Philippines and Hawaii, you know, even military families are being affected by that in Hawaii, by the oil leakage from the Red Hill storage facility next to Pearl Harbor. And so you have this consistent lack of care for the environment, for the local population, including the military families. And then that the climate change that's generated by the use of fossil fuels, because the Pentagon is primarily defending big oil, other big industries, resource extraction in many countries. I don't think anyone thinks there would have been a war in Iraq if Iraq's main export was like rutabagas or something. It really was an oil war. And we have oil wars at home. We have Standing Rock. We have other, we have the Alberta tar sands. But the climate change that's generated then goes into that feedback loop and creates more intense conflicts with droughts in places like Syria, Yemen, Libya, with storms, hurricanes in places like Honduras or Haiti. That generates refugee crises, but also generates rebellion. And of course, there are a lot of other, I don't want to be like environmentally reductionist and say climate change is the only reason for these conflicts. It's really vast inequalities, social inequalities, economic inequalities in these countries, ethnic religious divisions that are exacerbated, that really cause these wars. But climate change makes them makes these civil wars, these international wars, worse. And so you have this, you know, the Pentagon defending big oil generating climate change, and climate change making the wars even more intense. So this is something that really isn't talked about in Congress as they're passing much larger military budgets, is how spending the money on the military means we're not having a Green New Deal. We're not able to retool our own technology for a cleaner future. But also the rest of the world is suffering because of this emphasis on military too. You know, and the United States is not the only country engaged in it. China, Russia, Europeans are very much you know, part of this whole game. But if you want to look at international treaties, demilitarization would be a way to address the climate crisis and to resort our priorities.
Indeed. I just want to remind listeners, this is a KBOO community radio. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the host, Paul Rowland, and I have with me today Zoltan Grossman, a professor at Evergreen State College, and a long time, I don't know if you still do that much with all your academic duties, but you've been a community organizer, you're an author, and in particular, you've been focusing on, through a class that developed this website, Basewatch, you've been looking at the military presence in the Puget Sound area, which I find invaluable, and it'd be kind of interesting to see the actual greenhouse gas contribution of these specific bases. Maybe that's another research project for somebody. I know a bunch of people are calling. I apologize. I had to go to the air room. So it's going to be a little awkward to get callers in. Maybe I'll have my my board operator, Ty, who's not operating the board, because I am right now, to maybe write me down who is calling, and we can sort of plug them in directly. I apologize. I can't, for some reason, I wasn't able to get the voice of my guest in my headphones in the room that I'm accustomed to being in. So apologies for all that and for the late start, but here we are, and this is a live community radio, and we're talking about some important stuff. So yeah, I want to talk about, I know you've got an article I had pulled up on the computer about why defunding the police should lead to defunding the military or something like that. That was a Common Dreams article. I think it's ironic now, this whole, you know, because of the Mar-a-Lago FBI raid, et cetera, there's this whole sort of faux, you know, it's obviously, it's just a you know, fake anti-FBI stance, because, you know, you can guarantee that if you know, the progressive forces actually rose up, or you know, Black Lives Matter or the American Indian Movement resurgent or whatever, rose up and actually, you know, became a threat to, you know, the United States national security state, resource interests, et cetera, like at Standing Rock, that the FBI, that they'd be howling for the FBI to clamp down. But anyway, it's interesting that they're talking about defund the FBI, but nobody's really talking about defund the military. So,
yeah, and that's a point that Medea Benjamin and I made in that article, 10 Ways Defunding Police Should Defund War. And it's going back to what I said earlier, is really what happens within the United States affects what we do overseas, you know, even things like torture techniques in warfare end up coming back home, or what happens in the prisons here ends up being exported abroad. And you see a real history of that even in wars in the Philippines and Vietnam. This is not a new process. And so especially the connection between militarism and white supremacy in a lot of ways erode our generate wars abroad and oppression at home, and undermine our civil liberties here at home.
Looks like we've devised a system for getting a caller on the air. This is a caller. I'm not sure who you are. Maybe just identify yourself and go ahead and say your piece.
Hey, yeah, my name is Santiago. Yeah, man, you know, I think it's really important, you know, what you're talking about in terms of the you know, what happens with the military bases, especially on tribal land. I think you made a great point about the fact that we need to talk about, you know, colonialism. And I think that, you know, and realize that colonialism is still happening. And I think people kind of relegate that to a far and away place because we read about it in textbooks. But, you know, colonialism is an active process, and it's an active process because they have to maintain the status quo, you know? And I think that, and I liked how, you know, you had made a connection between defunding the police and defunding the military, but I think a bigger piece, you know, that could be connected in with that is that if we're talking about being anti-colonial, you know, then you have to be anti-American. And I think that that's a really important stance that we need to have, because America is a colony. And if you can't, you know, and it's funny because I feel like people try to say that you can't, you know, they want to be anti-colonial, but then when you start like telling the truth about America and start talking about how, you know, like even Martin Luther King, you know, he got killed for saying that America was the greatest exporter of violence around the world. And even he had an anti-colonial stance, and you know, and he was viewed rightly as anti-American because, you know, you can't pull on one thread without unraveling the entire sweater. You know, that's why you can make those connections.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, there's a common saying in Native studies, settler colonialism is not an event but a process, and it continues.
Yes.
And we can see, if we understand what happened on the land that we're living on, we can understand what has happened in other countries. If we understand what happened in other countries with settler colonialism in places like South Africa, Palestine, you know, we can look at that as something over there but not have the understanding that we have it in our own backyard. My current class is working on a project called Olympia's Hidden Histories, which is a series of walking tours of downtown Olympia to show kind of the history that has been masked of indigenous displacement, the displacement of a series of Chinatowns, of the natural communities of salmon and oysters, and how all those are trying to be revitalized now in the 21st century, and to kind of recognize that settler colonialism is not something in the past, it's not something just in other countries, but we have to understand it around us. And so I think Basewatch, the website that we set up in the class People's Geography of American Empire, at sites.evergreen.edu, Basewatch is an effort to look specifically at the military bases and the most obvious examples of militarization around what we now call the Salish Sea. Puget Sound is part of a larger entity now called the Salish Sea. But Joint Base Lewis-McChord, Naval Base Kitsap, Naval Air Station Whidbey Island are on indigenous land, and they're being used to, you know, conquer other indigenous lands, basically. And
I'd just like to comment, this idea of anti-American is, I think, is an important one to sort of parse out, because it obviously the United States as a political juridical entity is, I guess, what you're referring to, but you know, a lot of but there's also the land itself, and so I think a strong attachment to the land itself. Some people think of the United States or America as the land itself in some ways. I think it's just important to make that distinction. Maybe caller, go ahead and comment on that, and then let's go to another caller.
Well, I was going to say you can't separate the land from, I mean, because indigenous, you know, our people existed here before America. So saying that people having a connection to the land is, you know, it's, I feel like it's kind of a non-starter, because if you're anti-colonial, then I mean, obviously you're anti-America, because America is a corporate entity. It doesn't exist outside of whatever government institutions uphold it, because the land would still be here. So, you know, I mean, being pro-indigenous sovereignty would have to mean that you would have to be anti the government of America, which would dissolve America, but the land would still stand, because the land is not America.
Right.
The land is the land. It's Honu, you know, it's like, you know, everybody has a different name for it, you know, in Nahua, we say Anahuac, you know, our Pacific Island brothers and sisters say, they have a word for it too. I'm drawing a blank on it, but I mean, you can't really separate the two.
Yeah,
you know,
I guess all I'm saying is I've had this sort of discussion with my former co-host Jacqueline Keeler before she got her own program, is that she says that settler colonials never settle, and I always wondered about that, because I think many of us try mightily to actually forge a real connection to the land through, you know, both through struggle and a lot, and you know, support for indigenous peoples and for all the different struggles for justice in this territory, in this area, but also, you know, directly with the landscape itself, you know, with the rivers and streams and forests. And I think that was what inspired many of us who, you know, were involved in the forest defense movement, you know, back in the 80s, 90s until today. And so I just think it's important not to dismiss that, you know, the idea that, you know, obviously, you know, the imposition of wilderness areas and the eviction of indigenous peoples from those wilderness areas, the whole, as part of the whole colonial mindset, you know, not to confuse that with the legitimate desire for people to truly inhabit the landscape, or to actually settle it, as Jacqueline Keeler would say. But anyway,
I think one of the truisms that we see in the Pacific Northwest in particular, that if it wasn't for indigenous sovereignty, for treaty rights, we wouldn't have much of the land and water around us that we do. I mean, and it's not only things like stopping the oil and coal trains and shutting down those port terminals or preventing them to mitigate climate change, but also just incredible watershed restoration of bringing back salmon in places like the Nisqually watershed and reintroducing beavers by the Tulalip tribes to try and prevent floods in the spring and drought in the summer. These amazing, very innovative dam removals. The Lower Elwha Tulalip tribe led the effort to remove the two Elwha dams. And of course, we see what's happening in the Klamath and Snake now. And so the tribes are very much, tribal nations are projecting their power back into their ancestral homelands where they were removed either by treaty or by force in the 19th century. So it's not just a matter of land back. There are small patches of land that some tribes are getting back, but even the lands that they're not getting ownership over or jurisdiction over, they're being able in Washington State to co-manage. And so tribal sovereignty has been a positive force for both the tribes and the non-native community. And a lot of the rural neighbors of the tribes that used to fight treaty rights realize it's their only protection against corporate power. The military is another matter where the military is so powerful that it's been very difficult for tribes around the country to use treaty rights. It's another federal entity like the tribes. You know, there's a government-to-government relationship. Sometimes they're fighting against the military. Sometimes they have to cooperate with the military in order to protect the natural and cultural resources that are within those military lands. So they at least survive. And so there are a lot of very complex relationships mm-hmm. That we have in this area between tribes and military. Of course, Native Americans, like other indigenous peoples, Hawaiian Samoans, are way out of proportion in the U.S. military for a lot of different reasons. And so there's a lot of tribal leadership are themselves military veterans. That doesn't mean they support the wars, but they understand how to relate to the military in these ways. And a lot of the modern Native rights movements was started by veterans coming back from Korea, from Vietnam. And so there's a very complex relationship. There's an honoring of the warrior, not necessarily the war. Cultures, and that's very deep in a lot of the country as well. But I want to
let me just interject before you go on. I apologize to the caller. I cut you off because I was positive we had another caller, and apparently we don't. Again, we're having some complications here this morning, so bear with us. I'm having to be on the board, which makes taking phone calls a little awkward, but we're trying to work that out. My guest today, I'm Paul Rowland, host of Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio. And my guest today is Zoltan Grossman, who's a longtime community organizer, and he's been in the academic world for a couple decades. He is currently, since 2005, member of the Faculty of Geography and Native Studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. So go on, if you go on with your train of thought.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention the two other base clusters that I actually don't know as much about that are under the Navy control rather than Army Air Force. That's Naval Base Kitsap, which is actually kind of a cluster of different bases. The Bangor Trident Submarine Base, Strategic Weapons Facility with ICBMs, on these enormous Trident submarines, which are basically doomsday machines. A single one could really wipe out humanity. It's the largest concentration of nuclear weapons on the face of the earth. In Kitsap County, which is just north of here and west of Seattle. If Kitsap County was an independent country, it would be the third ranking nuclear weapons power on earth after the rest of the U.S. and Russia. So larger than UK, France, India, Pakistan, Israel, North Korea, the other nuclear weapons powers combined. So There's a group there that's been there for years, right at the fence line, called Ground Zero, which is trying to focus attention, and every once in a while does direct actions, but really focusing on the nuclear weapons. There's also a naval shipyard, a huge one in Bremerton, Washington, that can construct and break down nuclear ships and submarines. There are a couple of other facilities as well, but that one, there's been a lot of toxicity that's affected the workers, the shipyard workers themselves, and kind of a cover-up of some of that chemical contamination. Mm-hmm. So that's been going on for years. Then Naval Air Station Whidbey Island, there's a group called the Sound Defense Alliance, which is focusing attention on this very, very controversial base, which is home to the Growler jets, which is the largest, loudest jet there is. I've taken field trips up to Whidbey Island, up to the Deception Pass area, and you can't even hold a conversation in the early nighttime hours because these growlers are going overhead from Alt Field. There's also an outlying field near Coopville, which where they practice landings and takeoffs as if it's an aircraft carrier. And in 2019, the Navy added 36 more of these jets in a place that's already just inundated with thousands of flights. It's going up now to 110,000 flights a year. And people on the island, it's very stressful. There's also the groundwater contamination from the PFAS chemicals that we've heard about, those chemical, forever chemicals that are found especially in firefighting foam, and so are used for the safety of the planes. And so the Naval Air Station Whidbey Island has by far the largest concentration of PFAS, which is a type of PFAS, of any base in the whole country, like by orders of magnitude. There's also on the Olympic Peninsula, the large wilderness area, the beautiful coastal mountains to the west, between Naval Air Station Whidbey Island, which is in the Salish Sea, and the Pacific Ocean. There are electromagnetic war games with those growlers. And so I've heard stories of Vietnam veterans who try to find solace walking in the rainforest and then having these planes go overhead, really disturbing that. And these are like 130 decibels, really way beyond. And then there's also the question of possible crashes and accidents. And the Navy SEALs were trying to get permission to spy on people, on civilians in state parks, as part of a training operation, nighttime training operations. And a judge earlier this year said, hell no, after a real outcry. And so the Navy has really been flexing its muscles of, asserting its presence all throughout Western Washington. Yeah. But recently, just recently, the Attorney General brought a suit in 2019, and just recently a federal judge ruled that the Navy EIS for the new growlers was not adequate. It didn't address the noise issues, and so has to, in a sense, be redone. And so the Sound Defense Alliance has done an amazing job in raising public awareness of, making sure that people understand that there is opposition to the military expansion in their area, talking about the environmental and noise issues. And so, in a sense, the environmental issues and the noise issues is a way to show that, the military presence is supposed to ensure our safety and security. And when it's, even within the boundaries of the United States, when it's detrimental to the safety and security, even of people that are living within the United States, much less people abroad, then you have an opportunity for solidarity, for understanding, hey, these things also happen in other places, in Hawaii, in Guam, in Okinawa, in South Korea, in Honduras. This is how civilians have been treated around military bases in those countries for many, many years.
We're all under the thumb of the global militaries, and how are we going to rein them in? There's all these really noble and excellent community groups, as you say, but you know, they have relatively little power. They can, you know, maybe nibble at the edges of some of the egregious overreaches and toxic effects of the military, but there doesn't seem to be much of a consciousness, let alone sort of, you know, broader movement that's really looking at, you know, the question of the militarization itself. And anyway, so we are just about 5 minutes away from the end of the show, and I did want to ask you if you could perhaps send me a list of those various community groups that are working on those issues around you, and I can include that on my program page. But I kind of want to get back to maybe the last thing we talked about, which is you mentioned the massive concentration of nuclear weapons, and you know we're rightly concerned about the possibility of nuclear war arising out of the war in Ukraine right now. It's a terrible, not to mention the ghastly situation of the biggest nuclear plant in Europe being, you know, in the middle of a war zone under Russian occupation with shelling going on in it and around it, and the power having gone out briefly, which could have led to a total cataclysm. Anyway, yeah, there's these nuclear issues, but, you know, the United States is not far from leading the way on, you know, de-escalation of nuclear weapons, let alone the broader demilitarization question. And that's something that it's just the absurdity and the insanity of it all is just kind of driving me a little batty, and is kind of what tipped me over to really look at this whole question of militarization. You know, the Biden and the Democratic Party are still mired in the same old way of thinking, the same mentality that looks at the United States as sort of the number one power. Anyway, I don't know, it's a lot to chew on, but, you know, what is...
Yeah, I think the idea that militarization prevents real climate solutions is a very powerful argument, and we can see that with the war in Ukraine, that the European Union allowed itself to become dependent on Russian gas, to some extent Russian oil, and so now somehow fracking is an argument for rolling back the Russians and backpedaling on some of the climate commitments in places like Germany, United States has become an argument for peace in Ukraine, right? It's ludicrous because I don't think, I would think that the whole argument should be countries have allowed themselves to become dependent on a globalized fossil fuel economy, and that makes them, their security lessened and makes them more vulnerable, and that perhaps the thing to do would be to wean off of fossil fuels. Instead, the argument is being, well, the Russians aren't giving us gas anymore, so we have to increase fracking. And so, and you even, I think, see that discourse creeping into some of the arguments about liquefied natural gas here in the Pacific Northwest, because that's been a much harder nut to crack for the tribes and their environmentalist allies, because there's all this argument that, well, natural gas is clean energy, even though it, you know, its leaks contribute to methane, which is worse than carbon dioxide as a greenhouse gas. And also there's this new propaganda from some mainstream environmental groups that maybe nuclear power is an option, when in fact the early stages of the nuclear fuel cycle are very, very large contributors to greenhouse gases, uranium enrichment, for instance. So really the solutions to climate change and militarization are pretty much the same solutions, and that is to retool our economy, to downsize the military, to do it if people are concerned about security, to do it through treaty mechanisms where other militaries or a ban on all foreign bases. For instance, the U.S. has about 800 or 900 foreign bases. Other countries have only a few, but kind of the idea of pulling back and creating more independent, sovereign countries that don't have military bases, that don't have military interference. I think if you want to learn more about military bases, I think David Fine's books, Base Nation, and his newer book, The United States of War, are really good places to start. And I really think as a geographer that we need to focus on the military bases in our own backyard to understand what is happening in other countries. And we also need to be paying attention to other countries to understand what happened here first in our own backyard. So it's making that connection again between Manifest Destiny and overseas imperialism. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that tribal sovereignty has helped to heal the landscape here in the Pacific Northwest through dam removals, watershed restoration, I think that recognizing sovereignty, recognizing the independence of peoples around the world, is a way that they could take control of resource extraction in their own country instead of corporations coming in and despoiling their environments and cultures.
Indeed.
That they can take control of their economies, that they can, in a sense, not just decouple from American imperialism, but, the idea of foreign control, foreign conquest, and start to run their own societies. And that's a way for, in a sense, the whole world to heal from this colonial era that we entered into around 1492, and to look at it in our own backyard and understand that our own backyard is an extension of what's happening overseas.
Like I said on my program page, think globally, act locally. So I hope some people are spurred to look more in depth to this. My program page at KBOO.FM, Wednesday Talk Radio, has some resources, and we'll have some more after I get them from my guest, Zoltan Grossman, professor at Evergreen State College. We are plumb out of time. Thank you so much, Zoltan. Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
It. Yeah, it's
Thank
been
you.
Great.
Appreciate it.
All right, we're going to go out with a little more Buffy St. Marie.